Welcome everybody, and it is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. David Gustin. And Professor Gustin is from New York, and after getting his PhD degree in the University of Washington, he went to Pasadena and studied at Caltech as a colleague of Richard Feynman. And there he studied various things about phase conditions and critical phenomena in various systems, including gas observed on the graphite and superfluid helium. Yes, that is a mesmeric spectrum. And he's also interested in education and also dissemination of physics, so he wrote a graduate level textbook called The States of Matter, that's very famous. And also he directed and hosted a TV series called The Mechanical Universe. I don't know how many of you have seen that. And also, and now he's a vice provost and Frank Gillen Distinguished Teaching and Service Professor at Caltech. And recently, he has turned his attention to larger issues related to society and science. And one of these issues is today's topic, the end of age of oil. And with that, I'll turn to
thank you very much, Young. Can you all hear me? Is this mic on? Is it on? We'll get it turned up a little bit. Okay. Yeah, now you can hear me. So this is a book I wrote a few years ago, and by an absolutely astounding coincidence, it has exactly the same title as today's talk. Let's start out with a few myths about energy. The first one is that $3 a gallon is too much to pay for gasoline. I understand that here in Toronto it costs $1 a liter, which is about $4 a gallon. But even at $4 a gallon, that's $1 a liter, that costs about half as much as bottled drinking water. The fact is that gasoline is just about the cheapest liquid you can buy in the United States and Canada, and that's a big part of the problem. Oil companies produce oil. At least they say they produce oil. They talk about production and rate of production and so on. But no oil company ever produced a drop of oil. Oil is produced by the earth and the sun over hundreds of millions of years. The oil companies simply extract it and sell it, and that's why it's so cheap. We must conserve energy. Actually, the law of conservation of energy is one of the deepest laws in physics. So we don't really need to conserve energy, but we do need to conserve something. It's called fuel. When we run out of oil, the market place will take over and replace it with something else. We will look very carefully into that argument in the course of today's lecture. There's enough fossil fuel in the ground to last for hundreds of years. We'll look carefully at that as well. Nuclear energy is dangerous. At least a lot of people think that it's dangerous, but in fact, technically trained people tend to know that nuclear energy is the safest and most dependable source of energy we have. But it won't solve all our problems, as we'll point out in the course of today's lecture. The greenhouse effect from global warming are bad. I would argue that without the greenhouse effect from global warming, we would not be here. So we'll see about that. Brief history of energy. In the 18th century, heat was thought to be a fluid called caloric. Caloric was a conserved quantity in the sense that it was neither created nor destroyed. It just got transferred from one place to another. The caloric theory was precise and quantitative. If you had a certain amount of a piece of copper at a high temperature, it had a certain amount of caloric in it. If you put it into a cool bath of water, you could calculate exactly how much caloric would run out of the copper into the water, and thereby predict with precision the temperature at which the two bodies would eventually come to equilibrium. Nevertheless, not everyone was convinced, and Count Rumford was one of those. He was born Benjamin Thompson in New Hampshire in 1753, and he fought on the wrong side in the Revolutionary War, and so he decamped and went to England and later Bavaria. The Count of Bavaria named him Count Rumford, and that was his title. He's most famous for performing an experiment in which he measured he was most famous for pointing out that the drilling out of cannon barrels seem to produce a great deal of caloric out of nowhere, and that should not have happened according to the caloric theory. He made an attempt to measure how much mechanical work was equivalent to a given amount of heat, but he was not successful. The law of conservation of energy was then discovered some 9 separate times from his time down to the time of James Prescott Joule. But when something like that happens, when a law is discovered 9 separate times, the credit for discovering it goes not to the first person who discovered it, but to the last person, because he discovered it so well that it never had to be discovered again. And his name was James Prescott Joule. Joule did an experiment in which weights, 4-pound weights, descended to 36 feet each, driving a horizontal paddle wheel in a bucket of water. And at the end of after sending 16 weights down, he measured the change in temperature of the water, and he measured it without sending the weights down in order to find out how much it changed by itself. And eventually he reported, he did 3 other experiments of similar sorts, averaged the results, and he reported to the Royal Society of London that the amount of energy required to raise 1 pound of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit was equivalent to the amount of work required to lift a load of 800 pounds through 1 foot. And that constituted the discovery of the law of conservation of energy, and is one of the most important, as I said, one of the most important laws in all of physics. There are various forms of energy. Kinetic energy is the energy of motion. It can be organized in the sense of a car rolling down the road or a bowling ball rolling down the alley. Or it can be completely random in the sense of the motions of the atoms and molecules that make up the car or the bowling ball. The mean kinetic energy of random motions of atoms and molecules is directly proportional to the temperature. And so when something gets hot, it just means that its atoms and molecules are moving around somewhat faster. Then there are forms of potential energy. Gravitational energy can be potential energy in the sense of the weights that James Prescott Joule raised 36 feet above the ground. He endowed them with potential energy that eventually turned into work in heating his water. There's chemical potential energy, there's nuclear potential energy, and so on. There is one more form of energy that's important for our discussion, and that is radiant energy. That is the form in which energy reaches us from the sun across 93 million miles of almost nothing at all. This is a plot of intensity versus frequency, and you can see that the frequency has various names: radio frequency, infrared frequency, ultraviolet frequency, and beyond that, gamma rays, and X-rays and gamma rays. These are all parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, and they have different names, but they're all the same stuff. They all propagate through empty space at the speed of light. There is a narrow band between the infrared and the ultraviolet of visible frequencies, and those are the frequencies that we can see. By no accident whatsoever, our eyes evolved to be most sensitive to the colors of light as reflected from the sun. The lowest curve on this plot shows a cool body. It might be your own body. The temperature, the body radiates energy all the time, but it radiates chiefly in the infrared, and the radiation falls back down to zero before, let's see if I can get this thing to work. Oh, okay, so the radiation falls back down to zero before it reaches the visible. You don't glow in the dark because you're just too cool. This somewhat warmer body here has, again, a maximum deep in the infrared, but it slopes down through the visible. It's highest at the red end, so it looks red to our eye. That might be the temperature of an ember in the fireplace. The top curve is the sun, and the temperature of the sun, at the temperature of the sun, the maximum is very near the visible, and that's where what our eyes have evolved to see. With that, we can discuss the thermal behavior of the Sun-Earth system. The Sun thermonuclear reactions inside the sun heat the surface of the sun white hot, and that white light streams out equally in all directions. 93 million miles away, the tiny globe of Earth intercepts a small fraction of that. 30% of the radiation that falls on the Earth is reflected, and 70% is absorbed and must be re-radiated out of the space. Otherwise, the Earth would be warming up. The reflected energy can be seen in this picture of the moon. It's taken from the picture of the Earth taken from the moon. It's been seen in the colors of the polar caps and the oceans and the land masses and so on. The 70% that's absorbed must be re-radiated. It's a simple calculation to figure out what temperature the Earth needs to have in order to re-radiate into space 70% of the energy that falls on it. And the answer is 255 kelvins, or minus 18 degrees Celsius, or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I would argue that if that were the whole story, if the mean temperature, surface temperature of the Earth was 0 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 18 degrees Celsius, we would not be here. But that is not the whole story. Earth's climate is affected by various things. One of them is the tilted axis. When the Earth is at position A, here, the axis is tilted towards the sun and the north. It's summer in the north. 6 months later, when the Earth is in position C, the axis is still tilted in the same direction. It's the gyroscope. It always tilts in the same direction. But now the south is tilted towards the sun and the summer in the south. So the tilted axis creates the seasons. The El Niño cycle occurs because the water... water in the equatorial region flows towards the west. As it flows towards the west, the sun evaporates it, and it gets colder. As it flows towards the west, the sun evaporates it, and it piles up against the Asian subcontinent and evaporates there, and causes the monsoon rains that are characteristic of the climate of that part of the world. Once every 3 or 4 years, for reasons that nobody understands, the El Niño cycle relaxes, the water spreads back out across the Pacific, and it causes great storms in North and South America, and droughts in Asia and Australia, and a huge perturbation of the world's weather system. The thermohaline flow is a tremendous flow that occurs here in the Atlantic. The water flows north, evaporating as it flows north, making the water saltier and also getting colder as it flows north. At this point, a few hundred kilometers south of Greenland, it gets to be too dense to float, and it sinks. The water that sinks here will not emerge again for 1,000 years. It flows along the bottom of the ocean down here, around the tip of South America, and out into the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, where it eventually reemerges and comes back here. The offshoots of this thermohaline flow warm North America and Europe, and so the thermohaline flow has a great deal of effect on our climate. But of all of these effects, by far the most important is the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect in pre-industrial times, before we started fooling with the atmosphere, was 88%. That is the light from the sun. The Earth's atmosphere is pretty transparent to light from the sun. The light goes right through. But it is not transparent to the infrared radiation that the Earth tries to shine back out into space. There is water vapor, methane, carbon dioxide, and so on, in trace amounts in the atmosphere, and these are the greenhouse gases. These are the gases that absorb the infrared radiation, they re-radiate it back out into space so that it keeps the books balanced and radiates the right amount of energy out of the space, but it also re-radiates it down to Earth and warms the Earth from the temperature of 255 kelvins that it would have without the greenhouse effect to a temperature of 287 kelvins, or 14 degrees Celsius, or 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that comfortable temperature, we evolved, climbed down from the trees, and started building steam engines. There are various feedback effects in this story. For example, putting some greenhouse gases in the atmosphere warms the atmosphere a little bit, and that causes the polar ice caps to melt more than they would otherwise. But the polar ice cap melting means that the Earth is less reflective than it was before, so that reinforces the effect, that amplifies the effect. On the other hand, the melting of the polar ice caps freshens the northern water. It makes it less salty and could reverse the thermohaline flow that we saw before. And so it could lead to global cooling instead of global warming. These effects are very complicated, too complicated for a mere physicist like me. We like to think of in terms of limiting cases, and so I'll take two limiting cases. One of them is if you wiped out all the greenhouse gases from the atmosphere entirely, the temperature of the Earth would immediately fall to 255 kelvins or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, all of the water on Earth would freeze, and the Earth would become much shinier than it is, and the temperature would drop further still. So that's one kind of catastrophe that the Earth is susceptible to. There is a theory that the Earth went through periods like that early in its history. It's called the Snowball Earth theory, although not everyone here believes that theory. And the other limiting case is the case where the 88% greenhouse effect in pre-industrial times is raised to 100%, which is possible. We have no idea what would happen in that case, but we have a good example to look at in the case of the planet Venus. Venus is somewhat closer to the sun, so it should be somewhat warmer than the Earth, but that's a very weak effect, and it could be very Earth-like in temperature, but it isn't. The Russians have dropped a probe to the surface, and they found that it has a runaway greenhouse effect and a surface temperature hotter than molten lead. So the Earth could be a frozen snowball or a Venusian inferno. It is neither. It is this Garden of Eden that we all enjoy and that we are playing with by putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. This is the record over the last 400,000 years of methane in the lowest graph, the green graph, in parts per billion. Carbon dioxide in the upper blue graph in parts per million, and the temperature in the middle graph in degrees Celsius away from the mean. And you can see that the temperature followed the greenhouse gases very accurately over 400,000 years. For the last 10,000 years, the temperature has settled near its high end and has been relatively constant. That's the period during which civilization evolved. What this graph does not show, because it cannot show it, is what's happened in the past 200 years. In the past 200 years, the concentration in parts per million of carbon dioxide has increased to 380 from 280, and the concentration of methane has increased by about a factor of 2. If the temperature of the Earth were to follow those increases up like that, the results would be catastrophic indeed. The fact is, we are doing an uncontrolled experiment on the climate of the only planet we have. It is a very, very foolish thing to be doing. So what are the sources of energy? Before 1800, people pretty much lived on light as it came from the sun. Coal was known about, and some of it was burned for space heating, particularly in Europe during the latter period when trees started to become scarce. There were oil seeps at the ground, and so people knew about the existence of oil. There was something called swamp gas, which was analyzed around 1800 by Alessandro Volta to be mostly methane. So that is natural gas. And so the principal fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, were known, but they were very little used before the 19th century. Then in the 19th century, in 1765, a young technician named James Watt was fooling around with a steam engine when he thought of a better way of building steam engines. And that better way of building steam engines kicked off the Industrial Revolution. Coal was used in the steam engines that resulted, but it was also the steam engines provided stable roadbeds in which coal could be transported large distances from where it was mined to where it was used. The growth of urban centers raised a great demand for illumination, which hadn't changed since antiquity. And for a while, whale oil filled that need. But by the middle of the century, whales were getting scarce, and something else was needed. Edwin Drake, a retired railroad conductor, drilled the world's first oil well in northwest Pennsylvania in 1859. The oil at first was used for illumination and for lubrication, but in 1861, a German entrepreneur named Nicholas Otto invented the world's first gasoline-burning engine, and soon gasoline was in great demand for fuel, and oil wells were being drilled all over the world. The result of all this, now 200 years later, is that we can no longer live on light as it comes from the sun. Instead, we must have oil. Oil is the very root of our civilization. Without it, it's almost unimaginable that our civilization could survive. So where does the oil come from? Well, the graph on the left here, the pie chart, shows where oil is found. Two-thirds of it is found in the Middle East, 10 times as much as in South and Central America, 10 times as much as in Africa, 10 times as much as in the former Soviet Union, and so on. The fact is that the only player that counts is the Middle East. Nobody else matters. On the right, it shows a bar graph of how much oil was actually extracted in 1981, 1991, and 2001. And you can see that in 2001, we extracted the units are thousands of millions of barrels, and we extracted 1,000 of those, so that's 1 trillion barrels of oil. If you look at our worldwide oil reserves, you find that we have about a 40-year supply, about 40 years worth of oil at this rate of extraction, and so there's nothing to worry about. But that's the wrong way of looking at it, as we'll soon see. Marion King Hubbert was a geologist who had developed a considerable reputation for himself when, in 1956 approximately, he made the prediction that the United States would start running out of oil in 1970. This was such a bizarre prediction that he was not believed. He was almost laughed out of the profession. But when 1970 rolled around, he turned out to be exactly right. He had data for the United States up to 1950, up to here. He realized that the discovery, this curve is oil discovery. There's a second curve for oil extraction that comes after discovery. You have to discover it before you can extract it. The extraction would come would peak, have a bell-shaped curve like this, but it would peak about 40 years later, and that means around 1970. That wasn't the only way that he did his calculation, but that was one of the ways he did his calculation. I will ask your indulgence to put a few equations on the view graph, because this is a physics colloquium after all. So Hubbert's analysis was like this. He said, let Q be all the oil that's ever been discovered, and let Q naught be all the oil that ever existed. At first, when you start discovering oil and it's undisturbed, the rate of discovery grows exponentially, so it follows the differential equation for exponential expansion, which is dq dt equals aq. But after a while, you start running into the limits of oil that exists, and that can be modeled by multiplying the right-hand side of this equation by q naught minus q, where q naught is the total amount that ever existed, and q is the amount that you've already extracted. And this gives you what's called a logistic equation. The logistic equation is widely used in population genetics and so on, and business schools, because many projects have a form similar to this. But it's very little used by physicists. Physicists are not familiar with this equation. Nevertheless, you can find examples of it. I found this on the web. This is a curve of common thresher catches versus available biomass, and it's equivalent to the QDT versus Q, and you can see there's a nice parabolic curve that you get from prediction, where the parabola depends on the assumed parameters. of the curve. Actually, we would like not the QDT versus Q, but the QDT versus T versus time. For that, you have to solve the differential equation, and the solution is here. Again, a solution that's not so familiar to physicists, but is familiar to others. And if the form is not here, T naught is the position of the peak. T goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and that's the shape of the curve. If this form is not familiar to you, the form plotted it will be familiar. This is the logistics curve, and is very similar to a Gaussian or a Lorentzian. And you could use a Gaussian or Lorentzian to analyze the data. I think that Hubbert used this kind of curve because if you plot 1 over q to q dt, it's equal to aq naught minus q, which predicts a straight line that intercepts the axis at q naught, intercepts the q axis at q naught. Q naught for the United States was 150 billion barrels, as he discovered. Now people have made similar analyses for the world, and Q naught turns out to be about 2 trillion barrels for the world. This is the curve, a curve of the kind that Hubbert used. In red, and the actual data points in black. He had data up to about here in 1950. So you can see his prediction turned out to be exactly correct. And so Hubbert wasn't crazy after all. This is a plot of taken from British Petroleum, from BP, of oil reserves, proved oil reserves, and annual oil discoveries. In the proved oil reserves, we see that there's a big step function in the proved reserves of oil in the OPEC countries in around the late 1980s. But looking over at the right-hand graph, we see that there was very little oil discovered, certainly not much of it in the OPEC countries, in the late 1980s, so something else must have happened. What happened was that OPEC changed the way it imposed its restrictions on how much oil you could pump, depending in part on how much oil you claimed you had, and so the claims went up. This oil was not geological oil. This was political oil. All of this was political oil. On the right-hand graph, you can see the annual discoveries and production, that is the rate at which is extracted, and you can see that production crossed over to the annual discoveries around 1980 and has been more ever since. That means that since 1980, for the last 25 years, we've been using oil faster than we've been discovering it, which necessarily means that the reserves must have gone down, but you can see in the left-hand curve that the reserves went up always, because these are, again, I say, not geological reserves, but political reserves. The data on the right-hand graph is exactly the kind of data that Hubbert had for the United States when in 1956 he predicted that the oil would peak around 1970. And that today it should be possible to do that for the whole world. This is a model calculation that appeared in Scientific American in 1998. It's one of many model calculations. And the upper curve is exactly the same curve as you saw in the last graph of the actual production or extraction of oil. This curve is exactly the same curve as you saw in the last graph. The other curves are partials that add up to that. We don't know what will happen when this peak arrives. This is their prediction, that this peak will arrive, and their prediction is that it will arrive just about now. The upper curve shows what happened in the past, and you can see that we've actually had a couple of dry runs of peaks, one in 1972, when the Arab countries took advantage of the declining rate of extraction in the United States and embargoed oil, and again in 1979 because of the Iranian Revolution. And in both cases, the immediate result was mile-long lines at gas stations and despair for the future of our way of life, which was quickly forgotten when the oil came back. We don't know what will happen when this peak is reached, when this peak here is reached. but it will not be temporary. It will be permanent. It will be forever. You should use a certain amount of caution in evaluating a particular prediction like that one, because there are a number of factors that that detract from the accuracy of those predictions. One of them is that they used 1.8 trillion barrels of oil for the Q-naught, for the amount, total amount of oil that nature ever made for us. Looking at the data today, it looks more like 2 trillion barrels, so that would put off the peak for a little while. Technology, improved technology, is equivalent to new discoveries. It makes it possible to extract more oil from a given well. The increasing price of oil, and the price of oil has gone up dramatically in the past 2 years, as you all know. The increasing price of oil makes more oil available because it makes it possible to apply more technology and get more oil out. And the reserve numbers, as we've seen, the reserve numbers are an important part of any estimate. The reserve numbers that we've seen are very soft. That is to say, they're not very dependable. And so for all these reasons, the particular prediction that you just saw might be wrong, but the basic idea is right. That is to say, oil, the amount of oil that we have starts out at zero, it rises to a maximum that will never be exceeded, and then falls back down to zero again. And that means that we will be in trouble not when we pump the last barrel of oil, but when we pump when we go past the maximum, because the demand will continue to increase and the supply will start to decrease, and the maximum will occur at about the halfway point by symmetry, roughly speaking. It will be in the halfway point. And as we saw earlier, if the total amount of oil was 2 trillion barrels and we had pumped 1 trillion barrels by the year 2000, we've come very close to that maximum. Kenneth Hayes, who is an old oil man, said that he realized that Hubbard had been right and that the United States had peaked in its production of oil when he saw the following line in the San Francisco Chronicle in the spring of 1971. The Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for next month. That requires a bit of interpretation for those of us who are not oil men. The Texas Railroad Commission was the quaintly named cartel that governed the production of oil in Texas. When it announced 100% allowable, it was saying that it no longer was governing the amount of oil available. It was okay to pump flat out, and that meant it had lost control of the market. Immediately after that, OPEC was formed to do for the world exactly what the Texas Railroad Commission had done for the United States, to control the price of oil by controlling the amount of oil that was produced. I've always thought, based on this, that the signal that worldwide production had peaked would be when the Saudis and the Saudi Arabians decided that their oil had peaked, because they had been using their excess capacity the way Texas was using its excess capacity. For at least 20 years, they've been using their excess capacity to control the price of oil. Exactly that was announced in the New York Times on February 24, 2004. Forecast of rising oil demand challenges tired Saudi fields by Jeff Girth. It goes on to say the country's oil fields are now in decline, prompting industry and government officials to raise serious questions about whether the kingdom will be able to satisfy the world's thirst for oil in coming years. Now, this was a New York Times story, so it was very long, and it was written in a style in which each paragraph contradicted the previous paragraph. That's known as balanced reporting. So somewhat further on, it says, some economists are optimistic that if oil prices rise high enough, advanced recovery techniques will be applied, averting supply problems. But it takes it back in the very next paragraph by saying, but privately, some Saudi officials are less sanguine, and so on. I don't know whether someday we'll look back and decide that February 24, 2004 was the day in which Hubbard's peak was reached, and the world's oil supply declined after that. We're much too close to the situation to know. But to those who are aware of the Hubbard's Peak predictions, this was a chilling story indeed. On the other hand, in March 5th of 2007, a different story in the same newspaper, the New York Times, said many oil executives say that peak oil theorists fail to take into account the way that sophisticated technology combined with higher prices makes searching for new oil more affordable. The significant thing about this is that it speaks of peak oil theorists, that is to say, the idea that oil would have a peak is no longer so obscure. It's become part of the common parlance. The two reasons that it says that that there will not be a peak are reasons that I've already mentioned. The sophisticated technology and higher prices. Nevertheless, that does not alter the fact that the finite amount of oil is present in the earth, and it will someday run out. There is no question that it will someday run out. The only question is when. Typically, oil companies can produce one barrel for every three they find. This represents a tremendous opportunity. That is to say, there's when an oil field is exhausted, there's still a lot of oil left in the ground. People have improved the amount of oil that can be taken out of the ground, but not by all that much, and it gets very, very expensive to do. So who uses oil? Well, oil is used to make petrochemicals. There are some 6.4 billion people living on the earth today, and that number is expected to increase to 10 billion people by the middle of the century. Most of those people are reasonably well fed as a consequence of something known as the Green Revolution, which took place in the second half of the 20th century. The Green Revolution consists largely of fertilizing ground using petrochemicals. I don't think that the world could support 6.4 billion people without petrochemicals. I don't think it can support 10 billion people without petrochemicals. I think we're in a lot of trouble if we still have to run out of oil. Stationary power plants use oil. But it's easily substituted in those applications by coal or by nuclear. Home heating is an important use of oil, particularly if your home is heated by oil. But by far the most important use of oil is transportation. Cars, trucks, planes, ships, and trains all run on oil. And without them, it's very difficult to see how we will have our transportation system functioning. Global energy consumption, oil, gas, and coal, correspond to about 10 terawatts combined. Half of it is oil. There are a few renewable sources for a total of 13 terawatts worldwide. This is in 1998, but the numbers haven't changed very much since then. A total of 13 terawatts worldwide, of which 3.3 terawatts, or one quarter, is used in the United States. The United States has 5% of the world's population, uses one quarter of the world's energy. We are profligate users of oil, of all fuels. The 99 quads, quads are quadrillion British thermal units. That is a unit that will not be used again in this talk. So what fossil fuels are there? If oil goes away, what do we substitute for it? Well, first of all, oil refers not only to the light crude oil that we've been pumping up to now, but also to heavy oil and to oil sands and tar sands. Heavy oil is what's left behind in the oil fields when the light crude has been pumped out. You can get a little bit more out of any oil field, but the more you pump out, the heavier it gets. The tar sands of Alberta have been renamed the oil sands of Alberta to attract investment. And at the current price of oil, it's being mined successfully, but the operative word is mined. It takes 2 tons of strip mined ore to make 1 barrel of bitumen, a substance that's not rich enough to distill into gasoline. So hydrogen must be added. So some of the world's largest plants for converting methane, natural gas, into hydrogen have been built in Alberta. And that's characteristic of all these other fuels that you will see. They become more expensive both in cost and in principle as you go down the list. Shale oil is unborn oil. Oil was born when deposits of organic matter sank deep into the earth. The interior of the earth is heated by radioactivity. And if it sank just deep enough, it got converted to oil. If it sank too deep, it got reconverted into natural gas and may have escaped and may not have escaped. But if it didn't sink deep enough, it became shale oil, and shale oil is unborn oil. Shale oil can be turned into something that can be burned by heating it in a retort. Strip mining it, this is environmentally disastrous process, and people who have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in shale oil have given up because they say that it will always be energy negative, or if not, it'll be so close to a wash that it won't be worth the effort. Methane hydrate exists, and I learned today that it may be quite common. But nobody knows how much there is, where it is, how it can be mined, and so on. And so methane hydrate is formed when methane and water come into contact very close to the freezing point of water and under high pressure. And so it might exist at the bottom of the oceans or on the moons of Saturn or somewhere else. But nobody knows really, nobody knows how to extract it. And then there's coal. We are told that there's enough coal in the ground to last for hundreds or maybe thousands of years at the present rate of extraction. The fact that the estimates range over a factor of 10 from hundreds to thousands of years tells you that nobody knows how much coal there is. But the present rate of extraction is an even worse approximation. The largest deposits are in the United States, but there are large deposits in Russia and China as well. It can be liquefied as a substitute for oil. That was done by the Germans during the Second World War. They had coal but no oil, and so they liquefied their coal. But it's a dirty fuel. It comes combined with mercury, arsenic, sulfur, and so on that are very difficult to get rid of. It's the worst possible fuel from the point of view of the greenhouse effect because it's all carbon, and it turns oil into carbon dioxide. You'd have to increase the rate at which coal is mined by a factor of 5 to replace the oil. If you try to replace the current use of oil with coal, the coal is the conversion process is inefficient, and we get twice as much energy from oil as we do from coal, as I showed you earlier. And so you would have to increase the rate of production of coal by a factor of 5. That's almost unimaginable increase in the production of coal. And even that doesn't take into account the increasing population of the world, the fact that the poorer parts of the world want a higher standard of living, to be more like us, in other words, to burn more energy. And finally, it doesn't take into account the Hubbard's Peak effect, which is just as valid for coal as it is for oil. And so all things considered, I think that we are very likely to run out of coal as well as oil by the end of this century, and then we will be in deep trouble. So what does the future hold? Well, there will be an oil crisis very soon. I don't know whether very soon means that it's already with us, it's already upon us, or it won't be for the next 10 years or even 20 years. 10 or 20 years is nothing on the scale of human history. It's a negligible fraction. It's very important to us that the oil not run out sooner than that, because we would like to go on living our comfortable lives. But from the point of view of history, it's a negligible difference. And the oil will run out. There is no question that the oil will run out. It took hundreds of millions of years to make the oil. We are using it up in 100 or 200 years. That's not very good. If the oil runs out and we turn to coal to substitute for oil, then all fossil fuels, including coal, will start to run out, I think, by the end of this century. And doing that will have unknown consequences for the climate of the planet. But if the planet survives, we will be left with the solar flux and nuclear energy as the only possible sources of energy. And making use of those to run a civilization as complex as ours raises a number of dilemmas. The most important ones are social and political. But there are technical aspects too, and I can say something about the technical aspects of those problems. For the greenhouse effect, the technological fixes include a parasol at L1. L1 is the Lagrange point, the point at which a spacecraft could stay in orbit with a period of 1 year, one Earth year, between the Earth and the Sun. It's about a hundredth of the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And if you put up a big parasol there, 2,000 kilometers across, it would reduce the solar flux by about 2%, and we could go on burning fossil fuels to our heart's content without worrying about global warming. It's an amusing idea. It's probably feasible. We just returned the spacecraft from L1, the Gemini spacecraft. But it's a foolish idea. We've already seen that the fate of the Earth does not depend on the solar flux. The same solar flux, we could be a Venusian inferno or a frozen ice fall. The last thing in the world that the Earth will need in a future energy-starved world is a parasol at L1. Another idea is to sequester the carbon dioxide. Sequester means put it away somewhere. And it's being done in oil and gas wells in Scandinavia, and could be done elsewhere, but there is not enough volume in all the oil and gas wells to hold the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's already 100 parts per million of carbon dioxide has been pumped into the atmosphere, and 200 parts per million probably will be pumped in before we start to run out of fossil fuels at the end of the century. And so that you have to put away a few ten-thousandths of the atmosphere of the entire planet in somewhere, and nobody knows where to put it away. So that's a great idea, but it looks like it has limited application. Solar energy must be a source of supply. Hydroelectric power is a form of solar energy. The enormous weight of water at the bottom of a reservoir turns the turbine, which produces electricity for us. The water runs out into the watershed and gets evaporated and rains back into the reservoir. So that's an apparently renewable source of energy. And the trouble with it is that it's saturated. That is to say, we've built dams just about everywhere we can. We can't build very many more dams. And so we can't substitute the missing oil with hydro. Hydroelectric power accounts for about 25% of the world's electricity, and that's all it's going to account for. Wind has become increasingly popular, and as government subsidies reduce the price of wind farms, it becomes more popular, but it will always be intermittent, never dependable enough to replace the oil, and so we may inherit the wind, but we won't learn to live on it. Biomass is another source of energy. That's what we lived on until the 1800s, burning wood from trees. In Brazil today, biomass is used for half the gasoline or half the fuel that runs cars, so you could increase the amount of biomass. The trouble with biomass is that it's very inefficient. Only about 0.1% of the sunlight falling on the land turns into chemical potential energy because of biomass. You can do much better with photovoltaics. Photovoltaics are the gold standard for solar. The trouble with photovoltaics is that in order to make up the 10 terawatts of fossil fuel that we use today, it would require 220,000 square kilometers of photovoltaics. All of the photovoltaics made up to the present time would cover about 10 square kilometers. So making 200,000 square kilometers is a very tall order, maybe not unimaginable, but very, very difficult. On the other hand, the total solar flux that reaches the Earth is 20,000 times those 10 terawatts. So we are awash in solar energy. We just don't know what to do with it yet. And so that's possibly part of the solution to our problem. Conservation has got to play a role. Ultralight strong materials can be used to make vehicles that burn less gasoline. Hybrids are a good substitute for ordinary cars. I drive a hybrid. I don't see why anybody doesn't. We can make more efficient buildings and factories. We can get fuel from switchgrass and poplar. I've added sugarcane to that list because sugarcane is the only crop that fuel is actually extracted from in Brazil. We can use electricity more efficiently. We can have rebates in which people who buy gas-guzzling cars pay a fee, and it's rebated to people who buy efficient cars. That's exactly the kind of social engineering that our politicians are loath to do, and so on. And then there's nuclear. One form of nuclear energy is geothermal energy. It's nuclear because the interior of the Earth is heated by radioactive decay. There are a few places on Earth where geothermal energy is used for power. There are a number of places where it's used for space heating. But to use it for power requires much more, and there are only a few places where a geothermal source approaches close enough to the surface of the Earth to be used for power. Geothermal will always contribute, but will never be a major contributor. Fission is the kind of nuclear energy that we've been using up to now. It's efficient and works well. One of the problems is that nobody knows how much uranium there is to be mined in the ground. It's here in Canada and in Australia. There are supplies of uranium, but the estimates are that the total known resources would only last for about 10 years if you try to get 10 terawatts a year out of uranium fission. And in order to make 10 terawatts, it would require 10,000 gigawatt plants. That is to say, a gigawatt is about the biggest plant you can make, and 10,000 of those would make the 10 terawatts. But to make 10,000 new nuclear plants is almost unimaginable. None have been started in the United States for 30 or 40 years, and 10,000 brand new plants is a tall order. Fusion is perhaps the best hope for the future. 1 gallon of seawater has enough deuterium in it to replace 300 gallons of gasoline. So if you could make fusion work, it would work forever. It would essentially be a source of energy forever. But a great deal of effort has been put into fusion, and it hasn't worked yet. It is said that fusion is the energy source of the future, and it always will be. If you solve problems by using nuclear fuel, for example, you would solve a lot of problems, but you wouldn't solve the transportation problem because nuclear cars are not very likely in any time in the near future. However, advanced batteries could be used. The lithium-ion batteries that we use in our cell phones today pack 5 times the energy density of the old-fashioned batteries that we use in cars. You can also make hydrogen. If you had unlimited power from fusion, say, you could use it to make hydrogen from water, and the hydrogen could be used as a fuel. And it could be used as an internal combustion fuel. It can be used in fuel cells, or it can be used to make other fuels. So we understand the basic principles that we need to be applied to produce a civilization as complex as the one we have, but we're not pursuing those principles because we're complacent. As long as there's oil, we will use the oil. This is a picture of the United States taken on the night of August 14, 2003, when the great blackout occurred in the Northeast. You can see that a big chunk of the United States is missing. That's where the blackout occurred. If a tree falling in Ohio can create that much chaos, we live in an interdependent world. And this picture was probably faked, but it still reminds us of the problem. Scientists are supposed to make predictions based on their analysis of the situation, and so I make my prediction. My prediction is that civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century when the fuel runs out. I hope that my prediction is wrong, and I hope that making the prediction will help to make it wrong, because some of you will be inspired to go out and solve this problem, but I still stand by my prediction. In 2006, in the State of Union address, President Bush said, "We are addicted to oil." So he had become aware of the problem. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on February 2nd, 2007 said global warming due to human activity is real. It's time to stop the debate and do something about it. So that made it official. In the 2007 State of the Union address, President Bush had a series of specific measures to ameliorate the oil problem. 20% reduction in oil use by 2017, clean coal, solar and wind, and safe nuclear energy, plug-in and hybrid vehicles, clean diesel and biodiesel, ethanol from wood chips, grass, and agricultural waste. If you've noticed, I've mentioned all of these in the course of this talk. None of them are real solutions to the problem. But the fact that the president realizes that there's a problem is a big step forward. Maybe the next president will do more. So I, as a physicist, as a mere physicist, thought about what I could do to contribute to the solution of this problem. I thought about it and thought about it and finally decided that what I could do is write a book. And so I've written a book, and I thank you.
Are there any questions?
Well, the reason is because oil is governed by cartels. It's never been governed by the supply and demand. And the cartels, OPEC, for example, wanted to keep the price of oil per barrel within certain limits, not above a certain minimum, but below a certain maximum also, because they were afraid that if the price of oil got too high, we would replace all the oil with something else, and then they would lose their market. So they artificially manipulated the price of oil for many years, and that's what you've seen in these rise and falls. It may be that the recent rise was a natural rise, that is to say it was actually due to a shortage of oil, a worldwide shortage of oil, but we don't know yet. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, there are some people that dispute that fossil fuels such as coal and oil originated as from plant and animal material. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, Tommy Gold, who is a scientist at Cornell, has this non-biogenic theory of the origins of oil. It's been pretty well disproved. Today, the methods of analyzing oil are so sensitive that they can tell what kind of animals died and gave rise to each oil deposit. And so the idea that it's not biogenic is pretty much passé, and it's gone in the way of various other ideas. Yes.
Not only do we know where it is, we know exactly where it can occur. It's pretty simple. It's just determined by the pressure and temperature conditions. And we know many, many places where it does occur. And we also have produced from gas hydrate deposits, so it's not quite true that we said that.
Well, I think that gas hydrates may be a part of the solution, but they are far in the future and not presently available. But I appreciate your comments. Professor Edwards, who is the gas hydrate man here, told me this morning about the worldwide supplies, and this young lady was there as well. It's an impressive story, but it's not impressive enough to replace the oil that is going to be missing.
It's just a comment, but I wouldn't be quite as pessimistic about the uranium supplies as you've indicated. Of course, they are also limited. So, you talk about 10,000 years, yes, they're very limited. You're talking about 1,000 years.
Well, 10 years is probably an underestimate because the more will be discovered when they start searching for it and so on. And I agree with you.
There's a 2,000-watt society in Switzerland. That means they study the possibilities to reduce the usage per person to 2 kilowatts. And what they came up with is that with present technology, that we get between 3 and 3.5 kilowatts if you would have the money. And I think the most expensive part of the reduction in energy usage would be the buildings, the insulation of the buildings. That would be a bigger problem than transportation and anything else.
Yeah, the insulation of buildings is very important part of our energy balance. I agree. Yeah, I don't disagree with you. That's a good point.
I've heard it contended that if you calculate the energy cost of building a nuclear plant, manufacturing the fuel, disposing of the take care of waste, and decommissioning the plant, that the net energy production is close to zero.
That may very well be. We may need to invent more efficient ways of building plants if they're going to contribute to the solution to this problem. So I don't disagree with you.
What would your recommendation to the president be?
My recommendation would be to have an Apollo-like project to replace fossil fuels, that we need to replace fossil fuels as soon as possible, not when they run out, but now, say within 10 years. And we would try everything. Every idea gets its trial, and that's the way we would do it.